Beautiful secretary began sobbing even harder and pointed to the office door. "Come now, citizeness, let's not have any crying," said the first policeman calmly. The bookkeeper, feeling his presence to be completely superfluous, left the anteroom, and a minute later was out in the fresh air. There seemed to be a draft blowing inside his head, like wind ringing in a pipe. And in this ringing he could hear bits and pieces of the usher's tales about the cat that took part in yesterday's performance. Aha! Could our cat friend be making a return appearance? Having made no progress at all at the commission, the conscientious Vasily Stepanovich decided to visit the branch office, located on Vagankovsky Lane. To calm himself down a bit, he made the trip on foot. The Moscow branch office of the Entertainment Commission was located in an old house, peeling from age, set far back in a courtyard, and was famous for the porphyry columns in its vestibule. On that particular day, however, visitors were less struck by the columns than they were by what was going on beneath them. Several visitors stood frozen to the spot, staring at the young lady who was sitting and weeping at the table where all the entertainment literature was displayed and sold. At the moment in question, she was not engaged in salesmanship of any kind, and was instead waving off all sympathetic questions with a flick of her wrist. Meanwhile, from upstairs and downstairs, from every side and every department of the building, came the clanging of at least 20 phones. After crying for a bit, the young lady suddenly shuddered and shouted out hysterically, "Here we go again!" and then broke out in a quavering soprano, "A glorious sea, our sacred Baikal." A messenger who appeared on the staircase threatened someone with his fist and then joined the young woman, singing in a dull, toneless baritone, "Glorious the ship, the barrel of salmon." The messenger's voice was joined by others coming from farther away. The chorus swelled, and soon the song echoed from every corner of the branch office. In room number 6, the closest by, where the accounting department was, a powerful, slightly hoarse, deep bass rang out above the other voices. Accompanying the choir was the intensified clanging of the telephones. "Hey, northeast wind, roll out the breakers," roared the messenger on the staircase. Tears streamed down the young woman's face. She tried to clench her teeth, but her mouth opened of its own accord, and at an octave higher than the messenger, she sang, "The fine fellow hasn't far to go." The speechless visitors were struck by the fact that although the choristers were scattered throughout different rooms, they sang very harmoniously, as if the whole chorus were standing in one place with its eyes glued to an invisible conductor. Pedestrians on Vagankovsky Lane stopped by the courtyard gates and marveled at the gaiety that reigned in the branch office. As soon as the first verse came to an end, the singing stopped abruptly, as if it were again obeying a conductor's baton. The messenger swore under his breath and ran off somewhere. Here, the front doors opened, and a man appeared in a summer overcoat, a white robe showing below the hem. He was in the company of a policeman. "Do something, doctor, I beg you," the young woman cried hysterically. The secretary of the branch office ran out onto the staircase, obviously ashamed and embarrassed. He started stammering, "Don't you see, doctor, we have a case here of mass hypnosis of some kind, so it's essential that..." He didn't finish his sentence, began to choke on his words, and suddenly sang out in a tenor, "Shilka and Yerchinsk!" "Fool!" the young woman managed to yell, but rather than explain whom she was calling a fool, she broke into a forced roulade and started singing about Shilka and Yerchinsk herself. "Get a hold of yourself! Stop singing!" said the doctor to the secretary. It was obvious that the secretary would have given anything in the world to be able to stop singing, but he could not. And together with the chorus, his voice rang out with the news heard by pedestrians out on the street that in the wilds he was untouched by voracious beasts and unscathed by marksmen's bullets. At the end of the verse, the young woman was the first to receive a dose of valerian from the doctor, who then ran after the secretary and the other so that he could do the same for them. "Excuse me, my young citizeness," said Vasily Stepanovich suddenly, addressing the young woman. "But Has a black cat been here by any chance?
What cat? She screamed angrily. It's an ass we've got in this office, a real ass.
And then she added, let him hear, I'll tell the whole story. And she did, in fact, go on to relate what had happened. It turned out that the director of the Moscow branch office, who had made a complete mess of the leisure activities program, the young woman's words exactly, had a mania for organizing all kinds of clubs and circles. He was trying to butter up his superiors, yelled the young woman. In just a year's time, the director had managed to organize a Lermontov study group, a chess and checkers club, a ping-pong club, and a horseback riding club. And he threatened to have two additional clubs in place by summer, one for freshwater rowing and the other for mountain climbing. And then today, during the lunch break, the director walks in and...
And he's leading some son of a bitch by the hand, related the young woman, who comes from nobody knows where, and who's wearing tight-checked trousers and a cracked pince-nez with an unbelievable mug on him.
And then, according to the young woman, he introduced him to everyone in the cafeteria as a noted specialist in the organization of choral groups. The faces of the would-be mountain climbers clouded over, but the director encouraged everyone to be enthusiastic, and the specialist cracked jokes and showed off his wit, and gave his solemn word that the singing would take up hardly any time and would, incidentally, be extremely advantageous for everyone. Well, naturally, as the young woman reported, the first to jump up were Fanov and Kosarchuk, notorious office toadies, who announced that they were going to join the chorus. The rest of the staff then realized that there was no way to escape it, so they said they would join too. It was decided that the singing would take place during the lunch break, since the rest of the time was taken up with Lermontov and checkers. The director, in order to set a good example, announced that he was a tenor, and that was the beginning of the nightmare. The choirmaster specialist in Czechs intoned, Do, mi, sol, do. He dragged the shy ones out of the closets where they were hiding to avoid singing and told Kosarchuk that he had absolute pitch. Then he started to whine and bare his teeth, asked everyone to humor an old choirmaster, struck a tuning fork, and begged them to strike up a chorus of Glorious Sea. They did, and gloriously. The fellow in Czechs really did know his business. When they had finished the first verse, the choirmaster excused himself and said, I'll be back in a minute, and disappeared. They thought he really would return in a minute, but then 10 minutes passed, and he still wasn't back. They were overcome with joy. He'd run away. And suddenly, they started singing the second verse as if of their own accord, following the lead of Kosarchuk, whose pitch may not have been perfect, but who did have quite a pleasant high tenor. They finished the second verse, still no choirmaster. They went back to their places, but before they could manage to sit down, they started singing against their will. It was beyond their power to stop. They would be quiet for 3 minutes or so and then start up again. At this point, they realized that something bad had happened. Mortified, the director locked himself in his office. It was here that the young woman's story broke off. The Valerian had been no help at all. 15 minutes later, 3 trucks drove up to the gates on Vagankovsky Lane, and the director of the branch office and the rest of his staff got in. Just as the first truck came to a pitching halt at the gates and then pulled out into the lane, the office staff, who were standing in the back, their arms around each other, opened their mouths and filled the street with song. The second truck followed suit, and then the third, and they all drove off. Pedestrians going about their business cast only a fleeting glance at the trucks, manifesting no curiosity whatsoever and assuming that they were going on an excursion outside the city. And they were, in fact, going outside the city, only not on an excursion. They were going to Professor Stravinsky's clinic. Half an hour later, the bookkeeper arrived at the finance office in a completely befuddled state, with hopes of finally divesting himself of yesterday's receipts. Having learned from experience, he peered cautiously into the oblong office where the clerk sat behind frosted glass windows with gold lettering. The bookkeeper could see no signs of upset or disarray. Everything was quiet.
just as one would expect in a proper establishment. Vasily Stepanovich stuck his head in the window, which had a sign above it saying, "Deposits," said hello to the clerk, whom he did not know, and politely asked for a deposit slip. "Why do you need one?" asked the clerk behind the window. The bookkeeper was perplexed. "I want to hand over my cash receipts. I'm from the Variety." "Just a minute," replied the clerk, and then proceeded to put a screen over the hole in his window. "That's odd," thought the bookkeeper. His perplexity was natural under the circumstances. It was the first time he had ever encountered such a thing. Everyone knows how hard it is to acquire money. Obstacles to that can always be found. But not once in his 30 years of experience had the bookkeeper ever found anyone, whether an official or a private citizen, who had difficulty accepting money. But at last the screen was moved aside, and the bookkeeper again leaned up to the window. "Do you have a lot?" asked the clerk. 21,711 rubles. "Wow," replied the clerk with inexplicable irony, and handed him a green slip of paper. Having seen the form 100 times, the bookkeeper filled it out instantly and began untying his package. When he removed the wrapping, his eyes glazed over, and he let out an agonizing groan. Foreign currency flashed before his eyes. Packets of Canadian dollars, English pounds, Dutch guilders, Latvian lats, and Estonian crowns. "Here he is, one of those tricksters from the Variety," boomed an intimidating voice at the stunned bookkeeper's back. And Vasily Stepanovich was then taken into custody.
This ends Disc 7. The Master and Margarita, Disc 8.
Chapter 18. Unlucky Visitors. At the same time as the conscientious bookkeeper was in the taxi en route to his encounter with the writing suit, a respectably dressed man with a small imitation leather suitcase was getting off the reserved seat first-class car of the number 9 train from Kiev. This passenger was none other than Maximilian Andreevich Poplavsky, the uncle of the late Berlioz, an economic planner who lived in Kiev on what was formerly Institute Street. The reason for his trip to Moscow was a telegram received late in the evening 2 days before. It said, "I have just been cut in half by a streetcar at Patriarch's. Funeral Friday, 3 p.m. Come. Berlioz." Maximilian Andreevich was considered one of the smartest men in Kiev, and justifiably so. But even the smartest man would be befuddled by a telegram like that. If a man can wire that he has been cut in half, it's obvious it wasn't a fatal accident. But then why mention a funeral? Or could it be that he's in very bad shape and foresees that he's going to die? That was a distinct possibility. But the preciseness of the information was odd nonetheless. How could he know that his funeral was going to be at precisely 3 p.m. on Friday? An amazing telegram. But what are smart people smart for if not to untangle tangled things? It was very simple. There had been a mistake, and the message had been transmitted in garbled form. The word "I" had obviously come from another telegram, and been put where Berlioz should have been at the beginning of the telegram instead of at the end, where it ended up. After such a correction, the telegram became intelligible, albeit, of course, tragic. After the attack of grief which struck his wife had subsided, Maximilian Andreevich began to make plans to go to Moscow. Maximilian Andreevich had a secret that must be revealed. Although he did indeed feel sorry for his wife's nephew, who had died in the prime of his life, he was a practical man and saw that there was no particular need for him to attend the funeral. Nevertheless, Maximilian Andreevich had been in a great hurry to get to Moscow. What made him do it? Only one thing. The apartment. An apartment in Moscow. That's serious business.
No one knows why, but Maximilian Andreevich didn't like Kiev, and the thought of moving to Moscow had gnawed at him so persistently recently that he had begun to lose sleep over it. He got no pleasure from the Dnieper overflowing in spring, when the islands and the lower shore became flooded and the water merged with the horizon. He got no pleasure from the striking beauty of the view from the base of the Prince Vladimir statue. The patches of sunlight that played on the brick paths of Vladimir Hill in spring gave him no joy. He wanted none of that. He wanted just one thing, to move to Moscow. The ads he placed in the papers, offering to exchange his Institute Street apartment in Kiev for a smaller flat in Moscow, had produced no results. There were no takers. And if someone did turn up once in a while, the offer was made in bad faith. The telegram had given Maximilian Andreevich a shock. It would be a sin to pass up such an opportunity. Practical people know that opportunity doesn't knock twice. In a word, come hell or high water, he had to make sure he inherited his nephew's apartment on Sadovaya Street. True, it would be difficult, very difficult, but the difficulties had to be overcome, no matter what. As an experienced man of the world, Maximilian Andreevich knew the first thing he had to do to accomplish this goal was to get registered, if only on a temporary basis, in his late nephew's three-room apartment. On Friday afternoon, Maximilian Andreevich walked into the office of the Housing Committee of No. 302B Sadovaya Street in Moscow. In a narrow room, where there was an old poster on the wall showing, in several drawings, ways of reviving someone drowned in the river, an unshaven middle-aged man with frightened-looking eyes sat behind a wooden desk all by himself. "May I see the chairman of the Housing Committee?" the economic planner inquired politely, taking off his hat and putting his suitcase on the chair by the doorway. This, it would seem, simplest of questions, so unnerved the man at the desk that a change came over his face. Squinting with alarm, he mumbled incomprehensibly that the chairman was not there. "Is he in his apartment?" asked Poplavsky. "I'm here on a very urgent matter." The seated man's reply was again incoherent. But even so, the implication was that the chairman was not in his apartment either. "When will he be back?" The seated man said nothing in reply and looked out the window with a kind of anguish. "Aha," said the smart Poplavsky to himself and inquired after the secretary. The strange man at the desk turned purple from the strain and, again incomprehensibly, said that the secretary wasn't there either, that he was ill and that no one knew when he'd be back. "Aha," said Poplavsky to himself. "But is there anyone here from the Housing Committee?"
"Me,"
the man answered in a weak voice. "You see," Poplavsky began impressively, "I am the sole heir of the deceased Berlioz, my nephew, who, as you know, died at Patriarch's Ponds, and I am bound by the law to assume the inheritance that consists of our apartment, number 50.
"I don't know anything about it, comrade,"
interrupted the man glumly. "But see here," said Poplavsky in resonant tones, "you are a member of the committee and are obliged to—" At this point a man walked into the room. The man at the desk took one look at him and turned pale.
"Committee member Pyatnashko?" asked the new arrival.
"Yes,"
answered the man at the desk in barely audible tones. The newcomer whispered something to him, and the latter became completely flustered, got up from the desk, and seconds later Poplavsky was left alone in the empty Housing Committee office.
Oh, what a complication. All I needed was to have them all suddenly be, thought Poplavsky with annoyance as he crossed the asphalt courtyard and hurried to apartment number 50. As soon as the economic planner rang the bell, the door opened. Maximilian Andreevich entered the darkened hallway. He was a little surprised that he couldn't tell who had opened the door. There was no one in the hallway except a huge black cat who was sitting on a chair. Maximilian Andreevich coughed, stamped his feet, and then the study door opened, and out walked Karavyov into the hallway.
Maximilian Andreevich bowed politely to him, but said with dignity, "My name is Poplavsky. I am the uncle." But before he could finish, Kuravyov pulled a dirty handkerchief out of his pocket, buried his nose in it, and burst into tears. "Of the deceased Berlioz."
I know,
interrupted Kuravyov, removing the handkerchief from his face. "The minute I laid eyes on you, I guessed it was you." Then he was convulsed with tears and cried out, "What a tragedy, huh? How could such a thing happen, huh?" "Run over by a streetcar?" asked Poplavsky in a whisper. "Killed instantly," shouted Kuravyov, and the tears started streaming from under his pince-nez. "Instantly. I was there and saw it. Believe me, it happened in a flash. Off went the head. Then the right leg. Crunch. Right in two. Then the left. Crunch. Right in two. That's what you get with streetcars." Apparently unable to control himself, Kuravyov turned his face to the wall next to the mirror and began shaking with sobs. Berlioz's uncle was genuinely struck by the stranger's behavior. "And they say people aren't sensitive nowadays," he thought, feeling his own eyes begin to smart. However, at just that moment, a bothersome little cloud settled over his soul, and a reptilian thought flickered. Could this sincere and sensitive fellow already have registered himself in the deceased's apartment? Such things have been known to happen, after all. "Excuse me, but were you a friend of my dear and departed Misha?" he asked, wiping his dry left eye with his sleeve and studying the grief-stricken Kuravyov with his right. But the latter was in such a paroxysm of tears that nothing he said was intelligible except for "crunch right in two," which he kept repeating. After he had cried himself out, Kuravyov finally unglued himself from the wall and said, "No, I can't take it any more. I'm going to take 300 drops of valerian." And turning his utterly tear-drenched face to Poplavsky, he added, "Those damned streetcars!" "Pardon me, but was it you who sent me the telegram?" asked Maximilian Andreevich, agonizing over who this amazing crybaby could be. "He did," answered Kuravyov, pointing to the cat. Poplavsky, his eyes bulging, thought he had misheard. "No, I can't go on. I haven't the strength," Kuravyov went on, sniffling. "When I think of the wheel going over his leg, one wheel alone weighs about 360 pounds. Crunch! I'll go lie down and lose myself in sleep." At which point he vanished from the hallway. The cat stirred, jumped down from the chair, stood on its hind legs, spread its forepaws, opened its jaws, and said, "Well, I sent the telegram. Now what?" Maximilian Andreevich's head started spinning. His arms and legs became paralyzed. He dropped his suitcase and sat down on a chair opposite the cat. "I believe I asked you in Russian," the cat said sternly. "Now what?" But Poplavsky gave no reply. "Passport," snapped the cat and stretched out a chubby paw. Completely at a loss, and unable to see anything but the sparks burning in the cat's eyes, Poplavsky pulled his passport out of his pocket as if it were a dagger. The cat removed a pair of black, thick-rimmed glasses from the table under the mirror, put them on his snout, which made it look even more impressive, and took the passport from Poplavsky's trembling hand. "I wonder, will I faint or not?" thought Poplavsky. Kuravyov's sobbing could be heard in the distance, and the smells of ether, valerian, and some other nauseating abomination filled the entire hallway. "Which department issued this document?" asked the cat, staring at it intently. No answer was forthcoming. "Department 412, replied the cat himself, tracing his paw over the passport, which he held upside down. "But of course, I know that department very well. They give passports to anyone who walks in. But I, on the other hand, wouldn't give a passport to someone like you. Not on your life. One look at you and I'd refuse on the spot." At this point, the cat became so enraged that he threw the passport on the floor.
Permission to attend the funeral is hereby revoked," the cat continued in an official-sounding voice. "Be so kind as to return to your place of residence." He then bellowed through the door, "Azazello!" In answer to his call, a short little man ran out into the hallway. He walked with a limp, wore black tights, had a knife stuck inside his leather belt, was red-haired, had a yellow fang, and a cataract clouding his left eye. Poplavsky felt he was suffocating, got up from his chair, and staggered backwards, his hand clutching his heart. "Azazello, show him out," ordered the cat, and walked out. "Poplavsky," the recent arrival said softly, with a nasal twang, "I hope I know everything is completely clear." Poplavsky nodded. "Return to Kiev immediately," Azazello continued. "Stay quiet as a mouse and stop dreaming about apartments in Moscow. Is that clear?" This short little man, who scared Poplavsky to death with his fang, his knife, and his cataract, only came up to the economist's shoulders, but his actions were smooth, efficient, and forceful. First, he picked up the passport and handed it to Maximilian Andreevich, and the latter took it with a lifeless hand. Then the one called Azazello picked up the suitcase with one hand and threw open the door with the other. Taking Berlioz's uncle by the arm, he escorted him out to the landing. Poplavsky leaned against the wall. Azazello opened the suitcase without benefit of a key, took out a huge roast chicken with only one drumstick, wrapped in greasy newspaper, and put it down on the top of the stairs. Then he pulled out two pair of underwear, a razor strop, a book, and a case, and kicked everything except the chicken down the stairs. The empty suitcase was also sent flying. Judging by the sound it made when it crashed below, its top had come off. Next, the red-haired thug grabbed the chicken by its leg and slammed it so roughly and savagely across Poplavsky's neck that the carcass flew apart, leaving Azazello with only the drumstick in his hand. Everything was in a state of confusion in the Oblonsky household, as the famous writer Lev Tolstoy so justly put it. He would have said the same thing here, too. Indeed, everything in Poplavsky's vision became jumbled. A long spark flashed before his eyes, which then converted into a black serpent which for an instant blotted out the May sun. Poplavsky then went flying down the stairs, passport in hand. When he reached the turn on the stairs, he smashed in the windowpane with his foot and sat down on the step. The legless chicken tumbled past him and fell into the stairwell. Azazello, still at the top of the stairs, devoured the drumstick in a flash and stuck the bone in the side pocket of his tights, after which he went back to the apartment and shut the door with a bang. It was then that the cautious footsteps of someone coming up the stairs were heard. After running down another flight, Poplavsky sat down on a small wooden bench on the landing to catch his breath. A diminutive elderly gentleman with an unusually sad face, wearing an old-fashioned tussore silk suit and a stiff straw hat with a green band, was coming up the stairs. He stopped near Poplavsky. "May I ask you, citizen," the man in tussore silk inquired sadly, "where is apartment number 50? "Upstairs," was Poplavsky's abrupt reply. "My humble thanks, sir," the man replied equally as sadly and proceeded up the stairs, while Poplavsky got up from the bench and ran downstairs. The question arises, did Maximilian Andreevich rush off to the police station to lodge a complaint against the thugs who had brutalized him so savagely in broad daylight? Emphatically no, not at all. That can be said with confidence. To go to the police and say that a cat wearing glasses had just examined your passport, and that a man in tights with a knife had... No, citizens, Maximilian Andreevich was far too smart for that. When he got to the bottom of the stairs, he saw a door off the exit leading to a closet-like room. The window on the door had been knocked out. Poplavsky put his passport away in his pocket and looked around, hoping to spot his scattered belongings. But there was no trace of them. Poplavsky himself was surprised at how little that upset him. There was something else on his mind, an intriguing and tempting thought, to use the little man to test the apartment again. He had asked where it was, which meant it was his first visit. This in turn meant that he would fall into the clutches of the gang who had taken over apartment number 50. Something told Poplavsky that the little man would be exiting the apartment momentarily. Naturally, Maximilian Andreevich no longer had any plans to attend his nephew's funeral, but there was still time before his train departed for Kiev. The economist looked around and slipped into the closet. At this moment, a door banged far upstairs. "That's him going in," thought Poplavsky, his heart sinking. It was cool in the closet, and it smelled of mice and boots. Maximilian Andreevich sat down on some kind of wood stump and decided to wait. From the closet, he had a good view of the door of main entrance number 6. The Kievan had to wait longer than he expected, however. For some reason, the staircase remained deserted. He could hear well, and finally a door banged on the 5th floor. Poplavsky froze. Yes, those were his footsteps. He's coming down. A door opened on the floor below. The footsteps halted. A woman's voice, a sad voice in reply. Yes, it was his voice. It said something like, "Leave me alone, for Christ's sake." Poplavsky's ear was pressed close to the broken window. It caught the sound of a woman laughing. Brisk and determined steps came down the stairs. Then a woman's back flashed by. The woman was carrying a green oilcloth bag, and she went out the entrance into the courtyard. The footsteps of the little man started up again. That's strange. He's going back up to the apartment. Could he himself be one of the gang? Yes, he's going back. That's the door opening again upstairs. Oh, well, we'll wait a little longer. This time he did not have long to wait. The sounds of a door, steps halting, a desperate cry, the meowing of a cat, quick, rapid footsteps coming down, down, down. Poplavsky got what he had waited for. The sad little man flew by, crossing himself and muttering something. He was hatless, looked crazed, his bald head was scratched, and his trousers were soaking wet. He began pulling at the doorknob, so traumatized that he could not tell whether the door opened in or out. He finally managed to get it right and flew out into the sunshine of the courtyard. His test of the apartment concluded, Poplavsky lost all interest in both his deceased nephew and the apartment. Trembling at the thought of the danger to which he had subjected himself, Maximilian Andreevich ran out into the courtyard, mumbling just 3 words. "It's all clear. It's all clear." Minutes later, a trolley was carrying the economic planner in the direction of Kiev Station. While the economist was sitting downstairs in the closet-like room, the little old man was having a most unpleasant experience upstairs. He was the bartender at the Variety Theater, and his name was Andrei Fokich Sokov. While the investigation was in progress at the theater, Andrei Fokich had kept apart from the proceedings, and the only thing noticeable about him was that he seemed sadder than usual, and, in addition, that he had tried to find out from Karpov, the messenger, where the visiting magician was staying. And so, after leaving the economist on the landing, the bartender had gone up to the 5th floor and rung the bell of apartment number 50. The door was opened immediately, but the bartender shuddered, stumbled back, and did not go in immediately. An understandable reaction. The door had been opened by a girl wearing nothing but a white maid's cap and a coquettish lace apron. She did, however, have gold slippers on her feet. The girl's figure was superb, and the only thing wrong with her otherwise flawless exterior was the purplish scar on her neck. "Well, come in, since you rang," said the girl, fixing her lecherous green eyes on the bartender. Andrei Fokich gulped, blinked, and took off his hat as he stepped into the entrance hall. Just then, the telephone in the entrance hall started to ring. The shameless maid put one leg up on a chair, picked up the receiver, and said, "Hello." Not knowing where to put his eyes, the bartender shifted from one foot to the other and thought,
That some aid the foreigners got. Phew! What filth! And to save himself from such filth, he looked off to the side. The entire large, semi-dark entrance hall was crammed with unusual objects and articles of clothing. A funereal cape with a fiery red lining was slung over the back of a chair, and on the table under the mirror there was a long sword with a shiny gold hilt. Standing in the corner, as nonchalantly as canes or umbrellas, were three swords with silver hilts, and hanging on deer antlers were berets with eagle feathers. "Yes," the maid was saying into the phone. "Who is it? Baron Maigil? Hello. Yes, the artist is at home today. Yes, he'll be happy to see you. Yes, there'll be guests. Tails or a black dinner jacket? What? Before midnight." After finishing her conversation, the maid put back the receiver and turned to the bartender. "What can I do for you?" "I have to see the citizen artiste." "Is that so? In person?" "Yes," answered the bartender, sadly. "I'll ask," said the maid, evidently hesitating, and barely opening the door into the late Berlioz's study, she announced, "Sir, there's a little man out here who says he needs to see Monsieur." "Show him in," came Kuravyov's cracked voice from the study. "Go into the parlor," the girl said simply, as if she were dressed like a normal person, and she opened the door to the parlor and left the entrance hall. When he entered the room he had been invited into, the bartender was so struck by the furnishings that he forgot why he had come. Streaming through the large stained glass windows, the whim of the jeweler's wife who had vanished without a trace, was an extraordinary light, similar to the light in a church. Wood was burning in the huge old-fashioned fireplace, despite the hot spring day. Yet it was not the least bit hot in the room. In fact, quite the opposite. A cellar-like dampness enveloped the man entering the room. Sitting on a tiger skin in front of the fireplace was a huge black cat, squinting contentedly at the fire. There was a table that made the God-fearing bartender shudder when he saw it. The table was covered with a brocaded altar cloth. On the altar cloth, numerous bottles were arranged, pot-bellied, dusty, and moldy. Amidst the bottles, a plate gleamed, and it was immediately obvious that the plate was made of pure gold. By the fireplace, a short, red-headed man with a knife in his belt was roasting pieces of meat skewered on a long steel sword, and the juice from the meat dripped in the fire, and the smoke went up the chimney. It smelled not only of roast meat, but a very strong perfume and incense, which made the bartender, who had learned of Berlioz's death and his place of residence from the newspapers, wonder if they weren't performing some kind of requiem mass for him. However, that notion was so preposterous that he dismissed it out of hand. The stunned bartender suddenly heard a deep bass say, "Well, sir, how can I help you?" There, in the shadows, was the one whom the bartender needed to see. The black magician lay sprawled on an immense couch that was low to the floor and strewn with pillows. It seemed to the bartender that the artiste was wearing nothing but black underwear and black pointed slippers. The bartender began bitterly, "am the chief bartender and buffet manager of the Variety Theater." The artiste stretched out a hand sparkling with precious stones as if to seal the bartender's lips and began speaking heatedly. "No, no, no. Not another word. Not in any circumstances. Never. I wouldn't put a thing from that buffet of yours into my mouth. I, most venerable sir, passed your counter yesterday, and I still can't forget the sturgeon and the brinza cheese. My good man, brinza isn't supposed to be green. Someone must have deceived you. It's supposed to be white. And that tea, it's dishwater. With my own eyes, I saw some sloppy girl pour unboiled water out of a pail into your huge samovar, yet they continued pouring tea from it anyway. No, my dear fellow, that's not the way to do things." "Excuse me," began Andrei Fokich, stunned by this sudden attack. But I didn't come about that. The sturgeon's not the issue. How can it not be the issue if it's spoiled?
They sent a sturgeon that second grade fresh, said the bartender.
Dear fellow, that's absurd.
What's absurd?
Second grade fresh, that's absurd. Freshness comes in only one grade, first grade, and that's it. And if the sturgeon's second grade fresh, that means it's rotten.
Excuse me, the bartender said once again, not knowing how to escape the artiste's tongue-lashing.
I cannot excuse you, the latter said firmly.
But I didn't come about that, said the bartender, now completely at a loss.
You didn't?
The foreign magician asked in amazement.
What was it then that brought you here?
If my memory doesn't deceive me,
I've known only one other person in your line of work, and that was a lady sutler. But that was long before you were even born. However, I'm glad you've come. Azazello, a stool for the bar manager.
The one roasting the meat turned around, terrifying the bartender with his fang, and deftly handed him one of the low, dark oak stools. There was nothing else in the room to sit on.
Thank you very much, said the bartender, lowering himself onto the stool, the back leg of which then caved in with a crash. The bartender let out a groan and hit his rump painfully against the floor. As he fell, his leg upset another stool nearby, spilling a full glass of red wine all over his trousers. The artiste exclaimed,
"Oops! Did you hurt yourself?"
Azazello helped the bartender get up and offered him another seat. In a grief-stricken voice, the bartender refused his host's suggestion that he remove his trousers and dry them in front of the fire. Feeling extremely uncomfortable in his wet underwear and clothes, he sat down gingerly on the other stool.
"I love sitting low to the ground," said the artiste, "because then falling off isn't so dangerous. Now then, we were talking about the sturgeon, were we not? My dear fellow, freshness, freshness and more freshness. That should be every buffet manager's motto. Yes, well, wouldn't you like to have a taste?"
Here, in the crimson glow of the fireplace, a sword flashed in front of the bartender, and Azazello put a sizzling piece of meat on a gold platter. He sprinkled it with lemon juice and handed the bartender a two-pronged gold fork.
"Thank you very much, but I—"
"No, no, try it."
Out of politeness, the bartender put a piece in his mouth and realized immediately that he was eating something that was truly very fresh and, what's more, unusually tasty. But even so, as the bartender chewed the fragrant, succulent meat, he almost choked and fell a second time. A large, dark bird flew in from the adjoining room, softly brushing its wing against the bartender's bald head. Alighting on the mantelpiece, next to the clock, it turned out to be an owl.
"Oh, my God," thought Andrei Fokich, who, like all bartenders, was nervous and edgy. "This is some apartment. A glass of wine? White? Red? Which imported wine do you prefer at this hour?"
"Thank you, but I don't drink."
"How unfortunate. How about a game of dice? Or do you like some other games? Dominoes? Cards?"
"I don't play," replied the already weary bartender.
"That's the limit," concluded the host. "There is, if you don't mind my saying so, something sinister about men who avoid wine, games, the company of charming women, and good dinner-table conversation. People like that are either seriously ill, or they secretly disdain their fellow men. True, there are exceptions. Among those who have feasted with me, there have sometimes been extraordinary cads. And so, tell me what brings you here?"
"Yesterday, you had occasion to perform some tricks."
"I?" the magician exclaimed in amazement. "I beg your pardon. That isn't my sort of thing."
"Sorry," said the bartender, taken aback. "But what about the performance of black magic?"
"Oh, that, well, of course, my dear man. I'll tell you a secret. I'm not a stage performer at all. I just wanted to see the citizens of Moscow en masse, and the easiest way to do it was in a theater.
So my retinue here," he nodded at the cat, "arranged the performance while I merely sat and watched the Muscovites. But don't look like that. Just tell me what it was about the performance that brought you here."
"If you recall, among other things, paper money flew down from the ceiling."
The bartender lowered his voice and looked around in embarrassment.
"Well, everybody started grabbing the bills, and a young man comes up to me at the bar and gives me a 10-ruble bill, and I give him 8.50 in change. Then someone else..."
"Also a young man?"
"No, an older man. Then a third came. A fourth. I give them all change, and today, when I went to check the cash register, I look, and what do I see but strips of paper instead of money? The bar was 109 rubles short."
"Dear, oh dear," exclaimed the artiste. "Can they truly have thought it was real money? I can't believe they did it on purpose."
The bartender looked around, wryly and miserably, but said nothing.
"Can they really have been swindlers?" the magician asked his guest anxiously. "Can there really be swindlers in Moscow?"
The bartender smiled so bitterly in reply that no doubts remained. There were, indeed, swindlers in Moscow.
"That's beneath contempt," said Volant in outrage. "You're a poor man."
"You are a poor man, aren't you?" The bartender drew his head into his shoulders so that it would become obvious that he was a poor man.
"How much do you have in savings?"
Although the question was asked sympathetically, it was impossible not to view a question like that as indelicate. The bartender squirmed.
249,000 rubles in 5 separate savings accounts," came a cracked voice from the next room. "And 210-ruble gold pieces under the floor at home."
The bartender seemed to be riveted to his stool.
"Well, that isn't so large a sum, of course," said Volant indulgently to his guest. "Although, strictly speaking, it is of no use to you. When will you die?"
Here the bartender became indignant.
"Nobody knows that, and it's nobody's business," he replied. "True, nobody knows," came the same noxious voice from the study. "But it's hardly Newton's binomial theorem. He'll die in 9 months, that is next February, from cancer of the liver, in the first Moscow State University clinic, ward number 4.
The bartender's face turned yellow.
9 months, Volant calculated thoughtfully. 249,000. In round numbers, that comes out to 27,000 a month. Isn't that right? Not a lot, but enough if one lives modestly. And there's still the gold rubles.
He won't manage to cash those in,"
broke in the same voice, sending a chill through the bartender's heart.
"After Andrei Fokich dies, they'll tear down the house right away, and the gold rubles will be sent to the state bank."
"And I wouldn't advise you to go to the clinic, either," the artiste continued. "What point is there in dying in a ward, listening to the moans and rasps of the terminally ill? Wouldn't it be better to spend the 27,000 on a banquet? Then, after taking poison, depart for the other world to the sound of violins, surrounded by intoxicated beautiful women and dashing friends."
The bartender sat motionless and seemed to have gotten much older. His eyes had dark circles around them, his cheeks drooped, and his lower jaw sagged.
"But we've gotten off the track," exclaimed the host. "Back to business. Show me your strips of paper."
Shaken, the bartender pulled a package out of his pocket, untied it, and froze. Wrapped in the newspaper were 10-ruble bills.
"My dear fellow, you really are ill," said Volant, shrugging his shoulders.
The bartender got up from the stool, a strange smile on his face. "But," he said, stuttering, "but what if they try to... again?"
"Hmm,"
The artiste grew pensive. Well, then, come back and see us again, by all means. Happy to have made your acquaintance. Here, Karavyov popped out of the study, grabbed the bartender's hand, and started shaking it, begging Andrei Fokich to give everyone, his regards. Completely befuddled, the bartender headed for the entrance hall.
Hella, show him out! Shouted Karavyov.
Again, the naked redhead appeared in the hall. The bartender squeezed through the door, squeaked out a goodbye, and staggered on his way like a drunk. After going down a few steps, he stopped and sat down on the stairs. He pulled out the package to check the contents. The 10-ruble bills were still there. At that point, a woman with a green bag came out of the apartment facing the landing. Seeing a man sitting on the step, staring dully at 10-ruble bills, she smiled and said pensively, "What a building we have! Only morning, and this guy's already drunk. The window on the stairs is smashed again." She studied the bartender more carefully and added, "Hey, citizen, you're up to your ears in 10-ruble bills. How about throwing some my way, huh?"
"Leave me alone, for Christ's sake," said the bartender fearfully and quickly hid the money.
The woman laughed.
"Go to hell, you old skinflint, I was just joking."
And she started down the stairs. The bartender got up slowly, raised his hand to adjust his hat, and found that it wasn't on his head. The thought of going back was horrible, but he regretted the loss of his hat. He hesitated for a moment, but then went back and rang the bell.
"What do you want now?"
asked the hellish Hella. "I forgot my hat," whispered the bartender, poking at his bald head. Hella turned away. The bartender mentally spat and closed his eyes. When he opened them, Hella was handing him his hat and a sword with a dark hilt. "That's not mine," whispered the bartender, pushing the sword aside and quickly putting on his hat.
"Did you really come without a sword?" marveled Hella.
The bartender mumbled something and started swiftly down the stairs. For some reason, his head felt hot and uncomfortable in the hat. He took it off and, jumping with fright, let out a soft yelp. In his hands was a velvet beret with a rumpled cock's feather. The bartender crossed himself. At that very moment, the beret meowed and turned into a black kitten, which then leaped back onto Andrei Fokich's head and dug its claws into his bald spot. Letting out a desperate scream, the bartender plunged down the stairs, and the kitten fell off his head and scooted back up the stairs. Bursting out into the open air, the bartender ran over to the gates at a trot and left Devil's Den number 302B forever. What happened to him next is well known. After bursting through the gateway, the bartender looked around wildly as if searching for something. A minute later, he was in a drugstore across the street. Just as he uttered the words, "Tell me, please," the woman behind the counter yelled out, "Citizen, your head is all cut up." 5 minutes later, the bartender, wearing a gauze bandage, found out that the leading specialists in liver disease were considered to be Professors Biernadsky and Kuzmin. When he asked which one was closer, he lit up with joy when he learned that Kuzmin lived literally across the yard in a little white house. 2 minutes later, he was there. The house was old, but very comfortable, very cozy. Thinking about it later, the bartender recalled that the first person to greet him was an elderly nurse who wanted to take his hat, but since he did not have one, she shuffled off somewhere, chewing on her toothless gums. Next came a middle-aged woman who materialized next to a mirror and under what appeared to be an archway. She told him that the earliest appointment she could give him was the 19th, no sooner. The bartender realized immediately how he could get around that. After glancing with a fading eye through the archway, where three men were sitting in what was manifestly a waiting room, he whispered, "I'm terminally ill." The woman looked perplexedly at his bandaged head, hesitated, and said, "Well, then," and let the bartender pass through the arch. At that moment, the door across the way opened, a gold pince-nez sparkled, and a woman in a white coat said, "Citizens, this patient has priority." Before he could turn his head, the bartender found himself in Dr. Kuzmin's office. The room was rather long, and there was nothing frightening, medical, or solemn about it. "What seems to be the problem?" inquired Dr. Kuzmin in a pleasant voice, looking a bit apprehensively at the bandaged head. "I've just learned from a reliable source," the bartender replied, staring wildly at a framed group photograph, "that I'm going to die of cancer of the liver next February. Please stop that from happening." Professor Kuzmin arched himself against the high back of his gothic leather chair. "Excuse me, but I don't understand. You mean you've been to a doctor? Why is your head bandaged?" "What doctor? You should have seen this doctor," replied the bartender, and suddenly his teeth began to chatter. "Don't bother about my head. It has nothing to do with this. The hell with my head. It's beside the point. It's the liver cancer. I want you to stop." "But who was it who told you?" "You better believe him," the bartender implored impassionately, "because he knows." "I don't understand any of this," said the doctor, shrugging his shoulders and moving his chair back from the desk. "How can he know when you're going to die, especially when he's not even a doctor?" "In ward number 4, the bartender replied. The doctor then stared at his patient, at his head, at his damp trousers, and thought, "That's all I need, a madman." He asked, "Do you drink vodka?" "Never touch the stuff," the bartender replied. A minute later, he was undressed, lying on a cold, oilskin couch, and the doctor was kneading his stomach. Here, it must be said, the bartender cheered up considerably. The doctor stated categorically that the bartender showed absolutely no signs, at least at the present time, of liver cancer. But that since he was afraid and some charlatan had scared him to death, he should have all the necessary tests. The doctor wrote out instructions for him, explaining where he was to go and what he was to bring. In addition, he gave him a referral slip for a neuropathologist, Dr. Bourrier, saying that his nerves were completely shot. "How much do I owe you, doctor?" the bartender asked in a soft, trembling voice as he pulled out a thick wallet. "Whatever you wish," the doctor replied dryly and brusquely. The bartender took out 30 rubles and put them on the desk, and then, with unexpected softness, as if with a cat's paw, he placed a jingling stack of gold coins wrapped in newspaper on top of him. "And what is that?" asked Kuzmin, twirling his mustache. "Don't turn your nose up at it, doctor," the bartender whispered. "I beg you, stop the cancer." "Take back your gold," said the professor, feeling proud of himself. "You'd do better to look after your nerves. Bring in a urine sample tomorrow. Don't drink a lot of tea, and don't use any salt on your food." "Not even in my soup?" asked the bartender. "Don't put salt on anything," ordered Kuzmin. "Oh," the bartender exclaimed dejectedly, looking entreatingly at the doctor as he gathered up his coins and backed away toward the door. The doctor had only a few patients that evening, and by dusk the last one had left. As he was taking off his robe, he glanced at the place where the bartender had left the 3 10-ruble notes, and, instead of rubles, he saw 3 Abrau d'Ursau champagne labels. "Well, I'll be damned," muttered Kuzmin, trailing his robe over the floor and fingering the pieces of paper. Not only was he a schizophrenic, he was a swindler, too. "But I still can't understand what he wanted from me. All that for a urine analysis? Oh, I bet he stole my coat." And the doctor rushed into the entrance hall, dragging his robe by one sleeve. "Ksenia Nikitishna," he shouted shrilly in the doorway. "Check and see, are the coats still there?" As it turned out, they all were. But when the doctor returned to his office and finally took off his robe, he stood rooted to the parquet floor, his eyes trained on the desk. There, where the labels had been, sat a stray black kitten, looking very forlorn and meowing over a saucer of milk. "What is this, pray tell? This is really too—" Kuzmin felt a chill at the back of his neck. Ksenia Nikitishna rushed in when she heard the doctor's whimpering cry and calmed him down completely by telling him that one of the patients had obviously left the kitten there and that such things often happened to doctors.
They're probably poor, explained Ksenia Nikitishna, whereas we, of course...
They tried to figure out who had left the kitten surreptitiously. Suspicion fell on an old woman with stomach ulcers.
Of course she's the one,